Welcome to the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, November 26th. I'm Andrew Walworth. This is a rebroadcast of a conversation I had last spring with Professors Andrew Bush and John J. Pitney Jr. on their new book, Divided We Stand, The 2020 Election and American Politics. In the book, they provide a comprehensive overview of how that historic election was won and lost, as well as insight into how close the election really was. Bush and Pitney are professors at Claremont McKenna College in Southern California, and the conversation aired initially on April 20th. So, gentlemen, thanks for being here. Andy, I'll start with you and ask just about the title of the book, Divided We Stand, Are Americans More Divided Than at Other Times in Our History, and how is that reflected in our politics?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a complicated question because they are more divided than at some times, and not more than at other times. And I think Jack will add some historical flavor to this as well. But there have been times in American history when there was enormous division, and of course, during the Civil War, there was even much more division than we have now. You could say. On the other hand, if you compare this era to 30 or 40 years ago, I think the partisan polarization is definitely farther along. And I think people are more ensconced in their own kind of cocoons of information. I think we're more divided that way than in other times in recent history.
Jack, you see it the same way?
Yeah, and not only divided, but sorted. And that's a key term for political science. Obviously, the Civil War era, much deeper divisions, even the early part of the 19th century. But if you compare the United States to the 50s, 60s, 70s, you see an extraordinary degree of partisan sorting. States and congressional districts voting the same way for president and for the United States Senate.
Less ticket splitting, in other words.
Yeah. In fact, I did a book about the 1988 election. And one feature of that is actually in a majority of Senate races that year, the party winning the Senate seat was different from the party that that won that state in the presidential election. In 2020, there was almost complete uniformity. So the electorate is well sorted, Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other, and not a lot of split tickets.
So, Andrew, that would be partially explained, I guess, by redistricting over the years. But that can't explain it all, and certainly can't explain states because the state boundaries haven't changed. What's contributed to this sorting?
Well, I mentioned one thing which a lot of people look to, and that's just the difference in the way that people receive their news. But even before that, I think fundamentally the issue is that the parties themselves used to be much more heterogeneous. That is, there were a large number of conservative Democrats. There were a large number of liberal Republicans. And so there were a lot of voters out there who you might call cross-pressured. They might have had a party loyalty that leaned them one way, but their actual views on particular issues might have been leaning them a different way. And you just see a lot less of this now. And it's, in a sense, it's not completely an accident. To put it another way, the fact that we've had this kind of sorting was desired by important political leaders and even political scientists. There was a famous report issued by the American Political Science Association, or a committee of the APSA, in the 1950s that argued that we would be better off if we had more sorting, so it was easier to tell what you would be getting if you had a Republican or a Democrat elected. Franklin Roosevelt, even before that APSA report, had argued that what he really wanted was a liberal party. Maybe it would retain the name Democratic, but he wanted it to be more clearly a liberal party rather than mixed the way that it was. And later, Ronald Reagan made similar arguments that the country would be better off if there was a clear conservative party. And so now we do sort of have that, at least more than used to be the case. And it's contributed to this sorting.
Let's talk about the 2020 election, because you've got this great quote in your book. It's a line from the movie American President, I think from 1995. It's kind of a dated film, but you might find it on Netflix someplace. But you said the White House is the single greatest home court advantage in the modern world. And yet, when I look at the Real Clear average of polls and look back on it, I see that Trump never really, he was never ahead of Biden. As a matter of fact, he was significantly behind 7 to 10 points all the way back through October 2019. So this is pre-pandemic. He was behind. He never came ahead. I think the closest he came was about 4.5 points. So I'm wondering, if he had this home court advantage, what explains his inability to even sort of match a challenger, even in early polling?
Well, one another way to look at it is, given the headwinds he was facing, economic calamity, hundreds of thousands of deaths, one could argue it's astonishing that he did as well as he did. That by standard models, if you look at the state of the economy, one could argue that his share of the popular vote might have been much lower. And that he came as close as he did is in part a testament to partisan sorting, but also to the use of the advantages of incumbency. And he pressed those advantages about as hard, if not much harder, than any other president before.
So the other thing I was looking at was that in terms of the polling on the eve of the election, the RCP average has Biden up 7.2 points. And then, and it's about 4.5 points. Why were the polls so wrong, do you think?
There are a number of theories about this. I think the one that seems to be getting the most traction is that pollsters just had a hard time reaching certain voters, particularly Republican voters, who just didn't want to talk to them. And so it sort of skewed the results somewhat. I mean, it's the end result was about 2.7% roughly off of what the average of the polls said that it would be in terms of the national aggregated popular vote. And that's kind of within a margin of error of a 3% margin of error. But the hope, of course, is that when you average a bunch of polls, it's going to kind of reduce that margin of error. I think Republican voters were less likely to answer.
So this is the shy Trump voter phenomenon.
Yeah, but it wasn't just shy Trump voters, because you saw the same thing in a lot of Senate races, where it looked like the Democrats were setting themselves up for a really big night. And then, you know, these races that they thought were within grasp, they didn't win. And some of them, they didn't win. You know, not only did they not win, but they lost pretty badly. Susan Collins didn't even really come close to losing. Joni Ernst didn't really come close to losing. And so I think that it was not just shy Trump voters, but it's kind of shy Republicans in general.
So, Jack, you know, we just had about five Democratic polling firms come out with their sort of initial statement on what they think they did wrong. And this is what they said. They said there were several factors that may have contributed to polling error in 2020. There is not a single definitive answer, which makes solving the problem especially frustrating. This doesn't give me a lot of confidence that pollsters have figured this out. Do you think they will? And what's the consequence for the polling industry if they aren't more accurate going forward?
This is tremendously problematic, especially because when you're talking about election results, at least you have a metric against which you can measure the polling results. Do you vote for Trump? Do you vote for Biden? And then you can see how far off you are. But if you're just talking about attitudes about some public issue on which there isn't going to be a referendum vote, the only way to check one poll is to take another poll. Mm-hmm. And if there is something systematically challenging about public opinion research, the same problem is going to apply to the second poll that you take. This is hugely consequential, and it's not just the 2020 election. A lot of it has to do with response rates. People are less and less likely to pick up the phone for a stranger. In fact, today, my cell phone has rung several times, and I didn't pick up. And I, you know, pollsters are trying to find various workarounds, panel surveys, internet surveys, all of which are problematic. Internet surveys are difficult because a substantial measurable number of voters aren't online. So how do you measure what they're thinking? And if I had an answer to that question, I would sell it at high price to the polling industry.
Well, that's a fair point. So I want to get back to then the parties. You say in your book that we really have four parties now, which is kind of an interesting way to look at it. You've got a progressive and moderate wing within the Democratic side, and I guess a Trumpian and sort of a more traditional Reaganite conservative wing, I guess you'd call it, on the Republican side. Andy, as you were pointing out, this is not altogether new, that presidents have called for this in the past. How is it different? And going back to the title of the book, this closely divided country we have, with those four wings, how does that affect trying to get anything done in Washington right now?
Yeah, well, I think it, I guess the split on the Democratic side, in my view, is less serious or less difficult to bridge than the divide on the Republican side, but it's more consequential at the moment because the Democrats are the ones who have the majorities. And so if Democrats lose Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema in the Senate, that, you know, they can't get anything done. It's a big issue. You don't see it as much in the House, but it could start to become a bigger factor in the House because their margin in the House isn't very big either. And if some of the folks who got elected in 2018 as moderates in relatively moderate or conservative districts, you know, if they start getting nervous, it's going to be a problem for Democrats as well. So far, they've managed to paper these things over because most of the debate has been over, how many trillions of dollars to drop out of airplanes on the American people. And so that's the sort of issue that's, you know, easy to get lots of people behind, regardless of what other differences they might have. But, when we start winding up in different, more difficult territory, it's going to be a bigger issue. I think on the Republican side, it's not as consequential at the moment because they don't have power. But I think it's a bigger problem, especially as long as Trump himself continues to kind of interject himself into Republican Party politics. I think that's going to make it very difficult to overcome those divisions.
Jack, Andy makes a good point here, which is that while the energy may be on the wings of the two parties, the real power, at least within a divided Congress, is in the center, with folks like Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema on the Democratic side, and people like Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska on the Republican side. And I'll tell you guys something that regular listeners of this podcast already know, and that is that I personally am a big fan of gridlock. I think having to talk these things through and reach consensus is a good thing for the country. But Jack, how do you see it? Is the need to carry the center a feature or a bug of our political system?
I mean, Andy and I are big fans of the founding. And the founders didn't want the government to be efficient. They built friction into the system on the notion that friction creates light as well as heat. To get a bill through Congress, you have to get it through two very different bodies. And in Federalist 51, Madison explicitly explained that the bodies are different for a reason. And one could find certain features of the contemporary Congress that are problematic, but the idea that Congress doesn't operate efficiently, that is the ultimate feature and not a bug.
I would agree, except I think I would slightly revise that. I think in essence, I totally agree with Jack, but I would maybe quibble with the use of the term efficient, because I think there are different ways of being efficient. And what Jack is talking about is definitely one of those ways, and that's being fast, getting lots done in an unobstructed manner. But the other way of thinking about efficiency is getting it done right. And that can mean not getting it done fast. Sometimes it might mean not getting it done at all if the only way that you can get it done is not right. And so I would just, slightly modify what Jack said. And I think gridlock is in fact a feature and not a bug. But I think it brings its own version of efficiency if what you're looking to is the end product.
Well, let's turn to President Biden for a second. Here's something I read the other day. Sort of goes to this idea that you've got this really divided country and really a divided Senate and a divided House. everything seems to be pretty split up. You'd think, oh gosh, how do you get anything done given this? You have to compromise. Who knows how to compromise? Well, Joe Biden has more experience in Congress than all nine of his predecessors combined. He seems to be sort of bred in a test tube to be the kind of guy who would understand how to get things done in this body. Jack, do you think he's got an advantage? Do you think he has a plan? And do you think he can move things along there because he is a creature of the Senate?
Well, one thing that we're seeing is that he has learned from his own mistakes. In fact, I was just literally an hour ago in my Congress class talking about how he got himself in trouble a couple of times on judicial nominations, for example, saying that, we'd have to approve Robert Bork if Reagan nominated him. Well, Reagan nominated him and he had a different point of view. And wisely, I think, at least from a political standpoint, he has been a lot more parsimonious with his words, which if you're Joe Biden is probably the smart play. The trouble is, do the lessons that he learned about Congress in the 70s, 80s, and even in the 90s apply to the makeup of today's highly sorted and polarized Congress? And that is a big challenge for him because in some respects, it's a very different environment.
So Congress has changed so much that his experience might not actually apply at this point.
Well, yeah, as Andy pointed out, and again, Biden has been around long enough that he's seen these changes. When he came to the Senate, James Eastland was a Democratic colleague. It's inconceivable that somebody like Eastland would be elected as a Democrat today. And he got in trouble for having mentioned that. Kamala Harris took exception to his mention of willingness to work with people like Eastland. That said, he does have a great deal of institutional memory, a great deal of policy knowledge, and that will serve him well. But again, a lot of the political lessons that he learned in his early career don't necessarily apply today.
Are you surprised at the progressive nature of the administration so far, given the fact that he ran as sort of a moderate, a compromiser, president for all Americans, all these kinds of things? And yet, if you look at these first 100 days, it's a fairly progressive agenda and not a lot of outreach to the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, and not only not a lot of outreach to the other side of the aisle, but when the other side of the aisle or some portion of it has tried to reach out to him, they've been rebuffed, as was the case on the COVID bill. I guess I'm not too surprised, partly because, as you pointed out, the progressives are the ones who seem to have the juice at the moment. On the Democratic side, all the energy is there. There were advisors of Biden himself didn't generally say this for the most part, but there were advisors of his during the campaign who tried to assure Democratic voters on the left that Biden would run a very progressive administration. He has the capacity potentially to be more of a unifying figure, but he has demonstrated very much the capacity not to be as well. Going back to the Bork case, or even in 2012 when he was running for re-election as vice president, and he told a congregation of a black church that the Republicans and Mitt Romney wanted to put them back in chains. Right? I mean, that's Joe Biden too, right? So there are different Joe Bidens, and I guess I expected the one who was being pushed the hardest from whichever side, and that right now is the progressives. So I guess I'm not too surprised. I think there are many people who are disappointed, though, that there has not been more effort to try to bridge the gap.
Jack, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think a lot of it just stems from benefiting by the contrast with Trump. Even a lot of people who agreed with Trump on a lot of issues were dismayed by his behavior. And obviously, January 6th being the most dramatic example of that. The big test for the parties, obviously, will come in the midterm election. And the progressives are already showing that they can be problematic. Rashida Tlaib talking about abolishing the police. We write about in the book, it's very likely that that was one of the major issues that helped Republicans unexpectedly gain seats. You know, the whole notion of defunding, they say, well, we meant reform, we meant restructuring. Well, most people hear defunding, they mean they're going to hear abolish. And as James Clyburn pointed out, that's not really smart. Also, some Democrats were openly embracing socialism. Well, that may sound benign if your model of socialism is Denmark. It's not so benign if, like a lot of voters in Florida, your firsthand knowledge is of Venezuela or Cuba. That's something that is probably keeping some Democrats up at night. Are they going to throw enough interceptions to tip the next game to the Republicans?
Just talking about the parties, again, and going back to your book, one thing that I was struck by in the book was the third party vote was down significantly, and I think we all know that, but it was still larger than the margin of difference between the two candidates in Georgia, Wisconsin, and Arizona. And you argued that the Libertarian vote could have cost Trump, or you could argue that it could have cost Trump, Georgia, and Arizona. You know, I'm looking forward a little bit. I see this division within the parties. You hear the truly disgruntled are the people in the center. Is there an opening for a third party? Or is there the possibility the third party does emerge, but it just emerges as a spoiler, as it has so often in the past?
Well, I think, there's always the potential for a third party if there is sufficient dissatisfaction, or if there's some issue or range of issues that a large number of people perceive that the major parties are not addressing, right? So that's always out there as a possibility. The likelihood is great, in fact, overwhelming, that they would wind up just being a spoiler. And the reason for that is built into the American electoral system. At the congressional level, the elections are basically a plurality, single member plurality districts. So that's not a system that's well designed to produce victories by parties that get 10 or 15% of the vote. And the presidential elections, of course, the states, every state but two gives all of their electoral votes to the plurality winner within their state. And those two do it by plurality also, but just some of the electors are done statewide and some of them are at the congressional district level. So there's no aspect of the American electoral system at the federal level that operates on the basis of proportional representation of any sort. So you get situations like Ross Perot, who actually got 19% of the vote in 1992, and he still got zero electoral votes. Because he didn't win any state, and you have to actually win a state. So is there a potential for a third party? Yes, definitely. Could that third party, if it's well-designed, pick up 15% of the vote? Maybe. If it's really well-designed and has a really compelling message, is that third party going to win elections? No. I'll say almost certainly no, because I'm a political scientist, and I don't like to say absolutely no. But I will say almost certainly no.
It would have to be regional. I mean, I guess you'd really have to go back to George Wallace to find someone who actually won states.
Yeah, you'd have to find it. And of course, the sort of party that you're talking about where there's this kind of dissatisfaction in the center, that's not a regional phenomenon. That's something where maybe you could pick up 10 or 15 or 20% anywhere you go, but probably not a whole lot more than that anywhere you go.
Jack, again, feature or bug? We're sort of locked in this two-party system forever?
I think the parties are going to evolve. How that evolution proceeds, I don't think anybody knows for sure. If you look at a map of American politics over time, yes, we do still have the same parties that we did in the Civil War era. But if you look at the bases of the party, and I've done this in class, juxtaposing a map of, say, 1896 with a map of 2004, nearly every state has flipped. It used to be the Republicans were strong in the Northeast, the Democrats were solid in the South, and that has flipped. And we're seeing evolution proceeding as we watch. Georgia, which for a long time was a solidly conservative Democratic state, then it was a solidly conservative Republican state. It may be evolving in the same direction as Virginia to something as purple or even blue, moderate to liberal Democratic state, perhaps. So even though it appears that we're locked into a two-party system, the composition of the parties is subject to change and evolution.
Well, I'm just going to ask you one last question here. I really appreciate you guys taking the time today. But Andrew, when you look forward at the country right now, when you look at this deeply divided country, and I commend the book to people because it really gives you a good overview of how we got to the point we're in. Are you hopeful when you look ahead, or do you feel that these sort of divisive trends are bad for the country and might be getting worse?
I'm to be honest, I'm not all that hopeful. And I have to say that not because there's division, because there's always division. And we should expect that in a free country. People are going to have different opinions. They're going to have different interests. So the fact that there's division does not concern me. But what does concern me is the direction that that division has taken in the sense that people are so sorted that they're having a hard time, I think, even having any kind of empathy for anyone on the other side. And they're beginning to see people on the other side as the enemy, as the enemy of all that is good in America. The idea that people could agree to disagree, which used to be a staple sort of phrase that would be thrown out there, just doesn't seem to be in a lot of people's thinking these days. And you see a radicalization, I think, on both sides of people's willingness to go to extremes to try to win, because now they perceive the stakes as being so enormous. And so, I certainly wouldn't say that there's no way that we can get out of that. But at this point, I guess my hope meter is pointing in the opposite direction from being very hopeful, in the short run, at least.
Can I offer a great illustration of that? Dan Crenshaw, congressman from Texas, now he had a detached retina, very serious business. And I tweeted about it. I said, look, I had a detached retina. I know it is really, really serious and scary. So say a prayer for Dan. Whether or not you agree with him, say a prayer for Dan Crenshaw. Look at the comments. A lot of people said, no, I hope he goes blind. People actually wrote that. So if you want a sign of how badly polarized politics is, those comments neatly make the point.
Well, on that happy note, we're going to have to leave it. You've been listening to a conversation that aired initially on April 22nd with Claremont McKenna professors Andrew Bush and John J. Pitney on their new book, Divided We Stand, The 2020 Election and American Politics. As ever, I encourage you to go to Real Clear Politics and read one article from a publication or writer with whom you disagree. And from all of us at Real Clear Politics, enjoy the rest of the Thanksgiving weekend. Thank you for listening. Until next time, for Real Clear Politics, I'm Andrew Walworth.